Welcome to Elixir Wizards, a podcast brought to you by Smart Logic,
a custom web and mobile development shop.
This is season 13, The Creators Lab, where we're talking to innovators who are expanding what's possible with Elixir.
From groundbreaking projects to tools shaping the future with our favorite technology.
It may seem like magic, but it's really the result of talent and lots of hard work. Hey everyone, I'm Owen Bickford, staff engineer at Smart Logic.
And I'm Charles Suggs, developer at Smart Logic.
So we're your hosts for today's episode. And for episode 6, we're joined by Steven Solka, CTO at stand.io. That's stand with two D's. Welcome, everybody. How are you, Steven?
Doing great. I'm really happy to be here.
Great. Happy to have you here.
Yes. We'll start talking a little bit about Stand here in a moment. But just as an introduction to the community, do you want to tell us just a little bit about yourself, where you come from?
Yeah, I've lived around the DC area for the last 15, 20 years, been bouncing around the startup scene here, worked at a lot of startups in the fintech space, self-taught. So I dropped out of college. So I went down that journey. Yeah. And I joined Stand about 2 years ago.
Interesting. So I say semi self-taught, like I learned from a lot of people on the internet, but did not pay to go to classes. After the first semester, I dropped out as well. It'd be interesting to talk about that for a moment, because a large part of the community, engineering community broadly, comes from academics. What was your journey from college dropout to writing code for a living?
So my parents were programmers, right? So I had a lot of exposure as a kid, and they were teaching me HTML and like C. And so I was like playing with it. And then I never really did great with academics, memorizing and tests and stuff like that. But I attempted to go to college. But when I'm like in these like late classes, I'm like, oh, why am I here? This is boring. You know, I'm learning all these like fundamentals. I could just be doing this thing, right? You know, at the time, I'm a little gray at this point, right? There really wasn't code academies or anything like that, right? So I just dropped out and then just started applying for jobs, as many as I could get a hold of, right? Just hundreds of jobs a day. And looking at the job recs, they were just like, must have the college degree. And I was like, doesn't matter. And I just like, it kept applying until eventually someone gave me a chance. And I'd say that first year was pretty rough, right? Trying to like, you know, keep employed through that all. But, you know, the longer it went, the less it mattered. And now it's something that rarely ever comes up. And I'd say the only really impact I've had in my career is that you're not going to stick me in front of a whiteboard and have me write a bubble sort, right? And have it go well, right? I've just never had those algorithms burned into my brain. But yeah, that's the main impact.
I also didn't come from an academic background when it comes to the software. And I did finish college, but for journalism. Yeah. I'm curious, what tools did you find as someone who was learning on your own that set yourself up for success to the point that now you're starting companies and are making a splash and such?
Yeah. So I'd say the main thing was, so the first couple jobs were kind of a flop, right? As you go, I really didn't know what I was doing. But then eventually I landed at a defense contractor at the Department of Defense, and they worked for the Army Reserves. And I just happened to connect with someone that saw the potential in me and took me under their wing as sort of an understudy, right? And they were like, they basically pushed across the desk, here's 4 books you need to go read like immediately. Ones I remember, like the Gang of 4 Patterns book and Code Complete, like a lot of these foundational books. And so I was there for 5 years. This is before I had gotten into the startup life, and having that person sort of taking care of me from like my own professional development was instrumental. So I'd say finding someone that sort of will be able to work with you on a day-to-day basis and review your PRs and give feedback is really where I got most of the learning. That and messing things up in prod. I tell engineers that the fastest way you're going to learn is to fail. And since I've been an engineering manager before, but yeah, that's really the main way.
Someday, sometime, somewhere, I will mess something up in prod, but I never make mistakes.
Wow.
Just putting that out there into the world. That'll never come back to bite me. So, okay, that's great. So we know who Steven Solka is now. Great. I'm curious, that takes us up to Stand. Like, what is Stand for anyone who's not at Stand? And like, what's the problem that you're trying to solve there?
Yeah, so I'll give you the VC marketing spin of it, right? That's, we are an AI native deal intelligence and due diligence platform. So what that means, right, behind the scenes or a technical lens, is that banks and VCs, they have to make a lot of really critical decisions as part of their flow, decisions on who they're going to invest in, as well as once I've been invested, a bunch of micro decisions about risks across the deal. And while they're going through that process, it's a lot of document analysis and review to try to figure out what do I know and what I don't know. So we realized that with the AI technologies that we have available to us now, there's an opportunity to sort of make a disruption there. And so we're doing a lot of document processing and then combing through information as it comes across the fence to highlight things like red flags or missing material, as well as do first drafts of things that like that are named like investor memo, which is an example of a document. These things could be like 50 pages long. And so, yeah, it's document analysis and text generation is the main play here.
And so your audience, it sounds like, is primarily banks and venture capitalists. Is that?
That's right. Yeah. And you know, it's interesting. We started off 2 years ago. Our CEO, Julie, shout out to Julie. She's amazing. She's an ex-DOJ lawyer, right? So we actually didn't start selling to that group. We started selling to lawyers. And the idea at that time was like, law, from her experience, has a bunch of information that they need to sort through. And these technologies can help them do the needle in the haystack type of search. And so we thought we'd go sell to lawyers this solution, right? And then a year of that goes by and we realize, well, lawyers take a really long time to make decisions on if they're going to purchase software. And in a pre-seed stage company, we don't have that time. So eventually we found a group of people that had the money to pay and were interested in that and had a similar pain point. And that's how we ended up in this.
Nice. So this sounds like a very rigorous process. A lot of procedures that need to happen in a certain order. Can you talk a little bit about the data structures or what role Elixir plays in this type of system?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big Elixir monolith, right? So everything we do is through Elixir. Elixir is sort of our coordination layer. We do interface on the AI side with a set of models that are doing that sort of heavy lifting. And depending on the model, that either means reaching out to some sort of thing in SageMaker or reaching out to something that's in like an API, right? Like something like Anthropic, right? So there's talking to the AI, and but then there's all of the work to consume. Like we support like 77 different file types, right? So everything from a pitch deck, PDF, or a slide deck to things like CSVs, financial models that are in Excel documents. So there's a lot of document conversion that has to happen to get it into formats that the AI understands. So, you know, internally, you might imagine that as an Oban job queue, right? That's working through that work paired with Oban Pro, right? That has that workflow framework that allows us to say this job depends on this other job. And then lots of Kubernetes scaling up and down as bodies of documents come across the fence, if that makes sense.
Right. Are those custom models or like using some open source tools or services?
I mean, 2 years of AI development, it has changed so much. Right now, the answer is we are using a set of open source models, as one of which is fine-tuned on a public data set. We don't fine-tune models on customer data due to the sensitivity of the data. And then Anthropic has been one of the better partners for my publicly available models, but we started on OpenAI. We've switched out different open source models over the last 2 years. So I had to make sure that the architecture could basically be model agnostic as the state of the art.
What played into your decision to use Elixir here? People use a lot of Python in the machine learning space and some other tools. What drove you to Elixir?
There's sort of two versions of this story, right? So the biggest problem that we have in AI is not necessarily the like gen AI side of it, right? Lots of PhDs are solving that. People are standing up SaaS services to solve. The big problem I've observed across the industry is the user experiences for how do we take this generated information and make it consumable to people. These are just like not solved problems. And basically everyone has said, well, I'll just make a chatbot. Chatbots have had my take, hot take, that like chatbots are basically going to fade away eventually and they'll be a smaller part of the AI landscape. And so that means that I felt like I really wanted the ability to iterate quickly on the UI and be able to turn out lots of versions of our product early on. And so LiveView was something that I specifically was drawn to because, and this comes to the other side of the story, I was the VP of engineering at AngelList, and they were a really big Next.js Rails show. And so everything is React. In between those two are GraphQL. And the thought there was that when I was observing the engineers, adding a single button might involve changing or adding six files across the stack. And I was like, if I'm iterating on the UI and I don't know what I actually need to build, I don't want to be in a position where I'm trying to maintain all these different layers so it all makes sense. I just want to wire a live view button directly to the back end, and we'll figure that out later. And I'll say additionally that if you work in a really big Rails shop, it's been my experience that Elixir is this golden, the green pastures that the Rails engineers will talk about Elixir and say that if only we were in Elixir, this would be better, right? That's sort of a thing that you'll hear. And that's been my experience at several different Rails shops. So I really wanted to give Elixir a chance because I've heard such great things about it, and paired with the live view. And that was really what drove me here.
That's funny that I was that guy on a PHP team a few years ago. So by the time before I moved over to SmartLogic, the running joke was every week there was a meeting and someone would be complaining about a problem. And if we just rewrite it in Elixir.
Yeah.
I made that a thing. But you made an interesting point there. Yeah, the pattern that we're seeing, I think, across AI right now, and there are some exceptions, and I think you're working on one, is that, we're just going to keep talking to a bot as if it's a message thread. That's not how I work. Yeah, some of my job is talking to people in a chat thread. But so much more of my work is writing code into a code editor, that kind of thing. I'm curious, for this industry, for the domain that you're in, what are some kind of new novel user experience, maybe experiments or some ways you're using AI in an uncommon way?
Yeah. So I'll say again, two things I'm thinking about when you ask that question. One of them is that people don't like the prompt engineer, right? As an example, or there's just not a skill that a lot of people have, especially if you're not in tech, you're potentially like a VC or something. Right. And so one of the systems that we built is, I'm going to write your document for you. But to do that, I want you to give me a couple of your documents. And so if you give me a couple of your investor memos, I'm going to basically like reverse engineer what I believe to be your document writing process behind the scenes. And then I'm going to create some sort of internal template that represents all of the prompts that I would need to write something similar to what you just wrote. And now you can take this artifact and point it at some other company and say, write a doc like I showed you, right? And so I pulled up this statistic for Julie the other day, how many AI calls there are to do that sort of play, right? I think for one of our customers, counted 200 to 500 different calls that have to happen to do that work. And so if this was like a chat interface, right, to expose that, you would be going back and forth with ChatGPT like all day long, multiple days, right, to try and reproduce that. And so we're sort of the belief that people just want to get their work done, right? And we're going to abstract away all of the back and forth of the AI and wrap that around with, here, what task are you trying to accomplish? We'll make all the AI calls back and forth until we get to an answer. And then the other side of it is something that we're working towards is autonomous agents, right? So instead of you going to the AI and saying, write me a code that does X, we want our agents to come to you and say, I think based on what we've been seeing lately, you want a code that says X. Can I write that for you? Right. So that's like the code example. But the work example is, hey, a new document just came across the fence that said that so-and-so was employed, but they're missing their IP assignment agreement. You should really reach out to them and figure out what's going on there. So this is an agent reaching out to you to get you to do something. So this is the reverse of the chat model. So those are two things that are on my mind right now.
That sounds really cool. Cause as we're talking now, like I'm starting to see, the patterns are emerging, and maybe not as much experimentation as you would expect out of our software industry. So the chat thread model is one. I think the other pattern that I'm seeing pop up is, just add AI buttons. So like, just add a slash command or click this AI button and it will generate some text for you. I think what's really interesting about your product here is that it's doing some monitoring, it sounds like, in the background. And as facts or data changes, it's actually alerting your users to maybe potentially act on something that's changed, which is really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
How's that going? This sounds like a really hard problem. Is this going well?
Yeah, I'm really excited with our momentum that we have right now. So a year ago, we got selected for the AWS Impact Accelerator and then Techstars as well. You know, accelerators are great. I think what really matters to me, at least, is customers, and customers are coming through. So there's a lot of really positive reception to this. You know, one of the things that I'm constantly not surprised, but something to have to remember is that on these customer calls, because all these people are talking to chatbots, they don't understand what these systems are capable of doing, right? They're like, oh, I can put a file in and get a summary. And it's like, yeah, that's true. I could do that for you. And there are parts of our system that do that. But how about I write like a 100-page investor memo that currently takes you 3 weeks to write and I get it done in 30 minutes. And when we show them stuff like that, people just, there's a sea change in people's understanding what's coming next, is sort of all I'll say.
To counteract that, do you do much to try to like educate your users on what's possible and how to use the tool effectively? Or does it guide you through that based on its monitoring and trying to be proactive in terms of what it's bringing to you?
Yeah, I'll say that we've had a mixture of results there, right? We do try to guide as much as we can. We have material that we'll also show you to help you interface with these systems. And then Julie likes to say we're a no prompt platform, right? So that's the whole like trying to reverse engineer their process without having them to type anything out. But, you know, you still are in the business of, you have to like tune around the edges to get the best possible result, right? So once you get our output, you can still edit and try to do those things. And there have been people who struggled with that. And sort of the answer to those sort of things is getting on calls with them right now. We're so small. We just help them through that and try and explain. And so some of what we're doing is actually AI education and a little bit of prompt teaching.
Has that been one of your primary struggles or challenges, or are there others that have been more prominent for having success with
them? I'd say the biggest issue has been AI fatigue. How many AI tools have you two come across in the last year, right? There is so many companies. And at this point that like, people see us, they think, you know, I've seen this before. They equate it to some other tool. And the VC space has a bunch of these AI tools too, right? So it's hard to explain how we're different and to break through that initial fatigue that I think people are feeling, which is just this, so we're just so tired of AI.
Yeah, that's another kind of thing that's happened. Another pattern is a lot of code generation tools. Is that playing a role in how you're actually building the system, or is your focus just exclusively on delivering the product through AI?
Yeah. So something I realized about 6 months ago is working here, I've had to build a lot of skills at prompt engineering, right? This is what I do all day long. And I had this thought, what it would look like if I actually turned that on to code development, right? Could I change my process to sort of benefit from this thing that I've had to develop to solve professional problems, right? And so I shifted my entire development flow and I'm now coding exclusively using a tool called Aider, A-I-D-E-R, which is like a coding agent that you sort of interface with. Now I'll say that it falls over basically every 10 minutes. Like, these are not systems I would recommend for people, but I find that it's helpful. And I basically have Aider here and then NeoVim here, and I'm just bouncing back and forth between them, trying to get code to go the right direction. But I think it's really helpful for me in my position as a CTO of an AI company that's building agents to be like, I want to understand the agent's limitations in a space that I am intimately familiar with, right? So that's sort of why I've been coding that way lately.
How's it going with Elixir code generation? Because we're in a kind of a not entirely niche community, but you know, there's much more JavaScript and Python in the world, and Java especially. So that has been my impression from the outside, has been that like maybe Elixir, your ability to get quality Elixir code out of LLMs has been limited so far. Is that true still?
Yeah, I would say like first 2 months were absolutely terrible. Like, it just generates, and I'd say it's still terrible. Like, you know, it generates a lot of code that just doesn't compile. I've made progress with a technique that I heard in other AI coder communities that I've talked about, which is basically show the AI several versions of a file that exists in your code base. So for us, that was like our Ecto models or our live views, right? Like, or our components, right? And say, write a document that in a markdown file that you could show to someone that would explain the patterns and syntax of the files that you just saw. So now I have this docs folder that's filled with these markdown things that one's about Oban and then Oban Pro workflows. One's about LiveView. There's another one about fixing Elixir compile errors because that's like something it constantly struggles with. And so with having these little documents and showing it to the AI later when it like, okay, now I'm going to go write a LiveView helps bridge the gap to get it closer to generating code that's on the level of the Python. But it, you know, like I said, it's still every day producing compile errors and stuff like that. It just does better with that approach.
Yeah, I think I've pretty much never seen valid Elixir code generated by an LLM yet that I've worked with. Back to the functioning of the platform. If, let's say someone wanted to acquire Stand, how would they use Stand to complete the transaction?
Yeah, it's funny to say that our data room, so we've raised money. Our data room is in Stand, right? So that means all of like our safe agreements and our, I can't remember the term that is that we've incorporated within a specific state, right? That document, these documents exist in Stand as a data room and Julie shares them with third parties through Stand and they come and they look at them and they can interact with them just like anyone else. And it's a nice little thing. But from a lens of acquiring a company, there's a lot of due diligence that's involved in that. And so we've built a system that you can give us your due diligence checklist. So this is like a big Excel doc that has a bunch of questions that have to get answered before a deal can close. And we do that sort of reverse engineering play on it. And we bring it in the Stand. And now you have a giant checklist. That's every question you need to close the deal. And those questions on the right will tell you based on the data room you gave us, which ones you have the ability to answer and which ones you need to go out and talk to a founder about. And for the ones that it can answer, it will tell you like how confident it is in this answer. So there's sort of a workflow tool that happens in there and you go through there and each one of those has this been completed or not state and that you could interface with. But we call that our due diligence checklist. And so there's some banker somewhere that's working through that list and making sure that we have all of the different pieces to make sure that our deal is good. And then one day that deal closes. We're primarily focused on that information analysis and process improvement side of that. There's nothing that really currently happens in our system. Like when the deal closes, like confetti just shoot out and emails go off, but we're helping them through their day-to-day.
You use the term data room. Is that, say, a user's or an organization's collection of data within the system?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So data room is the term that smart logic has a data room somewhere in some lawyer's system, right? So data rooms could exist in a place called Google Drive, and most data rooms exist in these very expensive $100,000 a year companies that all they do is hold 100 documents and say they're safe, right? But that's a data room.
You know, something that I think almost all startups have to do at some point is pivot. You already talked about pivoting from legal, like law, lawyer customers to banks and finance. And if you're finding success there, how do you see this platform kind of growing in the next 2 to 5 years?
Yeah. So our main goal right now is going up the food chain, right? So bigger and bigger deals are better for us, right? So we have to sort of prove our value to smaller organizations that are maybe buying a company for $20 million, right? If we can prove ourselves to those organizations, we could be helping a company buy someone for $1 million or $1 billion, right? And so right now we're focused on this private equity space and trying to be successful there. I will say that the problems that we're solving for VCs and originally for lawyers, right? These are knowledge management and information architecture problems, right? Like everyone's feeling information overload, and there may be one day a Stand for like insurance companies that are dealing with all the paperwork that's involved with like a specific case, right? Now, maybe that's us, but maybe that's someone else that solves that problem. But I could definitely see if we're successful in the private equity VC space that we could move to other markets, but right now that's so far on the horizon that we're just trying to like make it here. I think that's really where the immediate term is.
Bigger deals. Everyone wants a bigger deal.
That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's hard because if you're transacting for $100 million to $1 billion, right, you don't necessarily want to trust a C-level company, right, with your data. And so it's a matter of developing trust in the industry and name recognition till we eventually get to a place where we could make a play there.
That's a hard lesson to learn as an engineer is sometimes like, yes, I definitely want to build the best product possible. It doesn't always equate to success. And especially when there are established players in an industry, it can be really hard to enter the market as a new player. And there's a bunch of shenanigans that happen, you know, so I don't know how much that has happened with you guys, but yeah, it sounds like you're growing and finding success, at least with what you built so far.
Yeah, it is a really hard lesson, right? It hurts, right? You put a lot of love into the things that you build and it's not necessarily best product wins, right? You know, for us, we sort of saw a sea change with our engagement with customers when Julie actually started showing up at these conferences that these VCs and bankers go to. Having Julie in the room with them was something that made Stan feel more palatable. Nothing happened in our product to make that happen, but you know, the people side of it. So it's sometimes about being in the right position physically such that you can capture these deals.
Perception is huge. Any regrets at this point about decisions you made or didn't make? Or
so I think that's a hard question, right? We've been running so hard for so long. You know, I wish that I had made more of an investment in integrating deeply with some sort of component framework. You know, I said that I really wanted to be running quickly and stitching various UXs together such that like I could get different versions of these AI interactions into production and see how customers reacted to them. But I think partially it's because I was in live view, but I didn't necessarily grab an off the shelf. I don't know how to say this one, but SHDN, like that shadow component library that's very popular in JavaScript land, or some piece like puzzle piece thing that I could piece together like combo boxes and auto completes. There's probably like three different type of heads in our app for various reasons. There's been a lot of like component drift and I wish that early on that I could have made that investment, but you've got no money, right? You got no paycheck and you're running as hard as you can. I'm just, you're not necessarily thinking about like, how am I going to be maintaining this in 2 years? But yeah, if I could go back, I would like probably build an adaption layer between LiveView and some JavaScript component library, or I would build my own. I'd come up with some sort of live view component library that would use.
Charles, hear that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Is that the magic word, components? So yeah, that's, well, you're singing to the choir here. Charles and I both went to ElixirConf 2024, which is super fun in Orlando, and did a bunch of work over the summer building kind of like a prototype component library, not something we intend to like share publicly, but something we would potentially use internally on client projects to get up to speed and not have to spend several weeks or, you know, days or weeks building out things that we always know we need, right? So, and since then, I noticed that there's been an uptick in component frameworks that are popping up in the Elixir space, whether they're specifically geared towards LiveView or Phoenix more generally. We're starting to see, this is something I think that maybe a year ago, we were all a little bit feeling the pain of, yeah, we can build it, right? We love building things. But people who are coming, who are seeing LiveView and Phoenix from the outside and very interested, a lot of times it's a hard sell if there's not a big set of components just ready to go, right? For all the reasons you were just talking about, you know, consistency.
It's a dream.
And right. So, and even just adapting existing component frameworks like Tailwind, UIKit, and all that kind of stuff. It's a non-trivial amount of time to take what you see in React and Vue Code and translate that into LiveView. Maybe there's a AI agent in the future that will just do that for us.
Yeah, I would love that. You know, 2 years ago when we started, we were doing Elixir then, and I think Surface was around and there was some component stuff in Surface, but
right.
There wasn't even, like, I know that now that Phoenix has core components, like I saw that got released. So there wasn't much. And so it meant a lot of building in-house, right? And so there's all these components out there that I've built. And then for the ones that I just couldn't build, like a type ahead, you know, I tried to marry those with JavaScript. But I got to say, like, I love LiveView. No regrets on that decision. But every time I have to go into the hooks land and come back, like, that hurts a little bit. It's really wonderful to hear that the Elixir community is also seeing that gap and is starting to like iterate on it. Cause I think that will really help new teams like myself that are trying to get companies up off the ground built on LiveView.
Type ahead. Someone build us a type ahead component, right?
Yeah.
We just need a live component.
There you go. Yeah, for sure.
Put it out there for $50 a download.
There we go. Right. Yeah. Someone's going to make some money. Yeah. So what's the Stand origin story? We talked about what it is and how it works. Before there was Stand, what was the alternative? And like, why does Stand exist in the first place?
Yeah. So I guess there's the people origin story, and then there's the Stand as a tool for VCs origin story, right? So the people origin story is I've worked at a lot of startups, and most of them are Series A forward. And so all of the problems that those companies have are like, we need to scale. I'm really sad that Graph is not going in the right direction, right? And so these are like people problems and Graph problems. But I had never really gone from zero to one. I've never seen what happened before A. And a friend of mine reached out who was working with Julie and said that we really need a CTO. And I met Julie, and you know, the rest is history. And so Julie was an ex-DOJ lawyer who defended his policies in front of the Supreme Court, and for herself, burnt out doing DOJ law, right? And thought, I really want to start something. And she'd kind of become a serial startup entrepreneur at that point and was trying to solve this lawyer problem, which is the information overload. I don't understand all of these different documents or problem. And at that time, I was really into note-taking. So I was contributing plugins to Obsidian and Logseq and all these different like tools. Cause I was like, really, as a VP of engineering at AngelList, I was like taking all these notes about all these different teams, and I wanted to understand them all. And so knowledge management was something that was really on my mind at that moment. So it caught me in the right moment, and I worked to start saying from a VC perspective, what they're doing is they treat it as a people problem, right? There isn't tools that do what Stand does. They currently hire junior analysts or mid-level analysts that are pouring through these documents and attempting to write the things that we write. And in that process can take, if we're talking about an initial startup evaluation, an hour to like a couple of days, to if we're talking about like coding a deal to close, weeks to months, right? So it just depends. And so something that can help them get away from the actual writing and get to the reviewing and the thinking side of their work, right? The higher level side is something that's really sought after, right? And so we're not really trying to take away the decisions of who you're going to invest in or, you know, what's an important thing about this company. We want you to look at our output and to think about what this means for your business and to edit it. You know, you have all the ability to like change everything. And so it's a matter of getting past the actual typing letters into keyboards and getting back to thinking sort of.
This is a fun season that we're doing here because we're talking to folks, some of whom are maintaining a package or a library or did a kind of a cool project. Maybe it's even a hobby project. And we're also talking to startup folks, CTOs and founders and so on. So I would expect that some portion of our audience has an idea at the back of their head that they might want to turn into a stand-up business someday. What kind of advice would you give to our technical listeners? I think we're going to safely assume that most of our Elixir wizards are fairly technical. If they have that idea and they just don't know how to like transform it into a business, what advice do you have?
Yeah, I'll get some things that come to mind are be careful building too much, right? Like, I think that's like the very common advice that we got, even just putting boxes and lines and putting them in front of customers. Like the faster you can get in front of someone who might give you money and say, is this something you would pay for, and get feedback at that level, the better off you'll be. A very common problem that builders have is they love to build, right? So the first time a customer sees something is might even be a prototype that's an Elixir, right? And at that point, you may have baked in assumptions into your prototype that you're going to end up throwing away. So like basically everything that I wrote for the first year was ephemeral. It's just stuff that just got trashed, right? So you have to be aware that sure, build stuff if you want, but it's all going to go in the dumpster like as one of the customer gives you that feedback, or you need to pivot or these things. And we used to have a clock of how many days since we had some form of pivot. And it was like every other week, some pivot, right? And so, yeah, be careful building too much. And then I'll say, okay, you have an idea and you actually want to do this full time. You know, I'll say we've had a lot of success with accelerators, right? A lot of fundraising is about who you know and then the network effect. And if you're like me, just some random Elixir guy, like you probably don't know a bunch of VCs, right? And so if getting connected into some accelerator, the most well-known one, Y Combinator, there are other ones like Techstars and AWS and Google has one. There's all these accelerators everywhere. Is sort of an opportunity for you to build your network and to be introduced to people that potentially could be your investors. And so, yeah, don't build and build your network is the two sides of it.
That rings true to me. I sometimes wonder, like, how much polish do you need? There's sometimes if you're building a house, you put up the frames and the interior decorator comes in and says, this is going to be your kitchen. This is going to be your living room. Everything's open concept or whatever, so on and so forth. And some people get it. They can walk into the room and kind of fill in, imagine the drywall and what things are going to look like eventually. But is it a hard sell if you're prototyping and demonstrating without a lot of polish? Is that a challenge you've seen, or is it maybe easier than we would expect?
There's always going to be someone that looks at this and says there's not enough polish. I can't tell you that's not going to happen. And there really isn't a version of your product that you will build as a pre-seed company that will have that. I mean, we just shipped a feature that is closing checks right now that lets you, it's the report writing one that I mentioned, the one that writes like 100-page reports. You can't even delete them. We cut a corner because I didn't want to do soft deletes and we needed to get out the door. And so yeah, it doesn't have polish, right? But so we asked our customers to just ignore the extra lines of reports that they have, and we'll ship deleting later, right? But I'll say that your customers are surprisingly forgiving, right? And for you to be successful to get a company off the ground, you've got to be chasing a really strong pain point, something that like haunts them day to day, right? And so this was ours for us. And when you found that pain point, they're not going to care that you don't have a delete button, right? They're not going to care that they're looking at screens that are, you know, boxes and lines. They're going to say, when can I sign up? That's what you want to hear when you show them something like that. Like, this is amazing. I want this.
Bingo.
Right. And so if you're getting like, this is not real enough, then you probably haven't found the pain point or the customer that's like the right combination that will make that successful. Or there could be a lot of other things, but I think that's my reaction.
Sounds right. Yeah.
How have you found pricing model plays into attracting customers, and does it affect their willingness to like ignore that it's not a polished UI and doesn't have all the features and whistles yet?
Yeah. I mean, I'll say of all the time I've spent in startups, and I'll say this is first true for Series A as well as pre-seed, pricing is the hardest problem I've encountered. Right. That's beyond naming, right? Pricing is a very hard problem. And we don't have our prices published, but I'll say that we're not selling apps on the App Store, right? Like to sign up for us is 4 digits a month, right? So in the range of $5,000 a month, and you can play that out. And so even though our price point is on the high end, right? Because we found the right problem set, because we're like literally saving them weeks of time with the work that we're doing, they're very willing to have some edges around it. But that doesn't mean that we pick the right pricing, right? There's so many different ways to get pricing wrong. And I think a lot about my time at Upside Travel, right? Which was this local DC startup that really tried to make it big by selling travel to people going around business traveling, right? And so we're like, oh, we'll give you a gift card if you book your American Airlines with us instead of American Airlines, right? And you will like make it all work basically. And that was their pricing model. And literally $100 million later, like spent, that was the wrong pricing model. And then you might notice that there's no more Upside Business Travel, right? And because the pricing model, eventually they realized that selling to companies that do travel for like, so I'm going to sell to SmartLogic, and SmartLogic uses Upside, and then we give the savings back to SmartLogic instead of the individual business driver. That was the right model, but it wasn't enough time to sort of save it. So I guess I'm just noting that yes, polish and price is connected. People are generally pretty forgiving, but pricing in general is really hard, and you can sink your business on it too.
Yeah. So I got to say, I love that we're talking business. So Elixir Wizards is typically a show about code.
Sorry. And, you know, I'm so sorry.
No, actually, I literally do enjoy this conversation, because we take it for granted sometimes that we just need to write some code, right? And mm-hmm. all the problems will be solved. But there's so much more to, we got to get paid by customers who actually use the thing. And
yeah,
there's a lot of complexity just to that side of the equation. So no, this is great. And I'm sure our audience is going to really benefit from the conversation. I'm kind of curious, part of operating a business, especially a very new business, is finding the direction. You found the direction, I think. You're going to always have customer feedback and maybe requests for features and things. Do you have any fun requests that you can talk about? And B, maybe talk about bigger picture, like how, as a CTO, how you manage solving tech debt problems versus balancing that with incoming requests for features and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm not sure on the fun front. So one of the things that I'll say is, early on when I was working with Julie, a lot of things that we struggled with was talking to customers and saying, what is the product like right now, right? And specifically, what does it do? And there would be a lot of questions about, okay, does it do X, Y, and Z? And Julie, as a lawyer, right, is very methodical in exactly what we do currently do and what we don't currently do, right? And so what that meant was a lot of lost sales early on. And so eventually I got to some advice that I gave to Julie that has been helpful, which is that, like, if someone's asking for something that I tell you I can get this built for their start date, then we already have it, right? Like, if they're coming into our product yep. and they can use that thing, then we're not lying to them. We're just saying that it's on the bubble. It'll be available to you when you come online. And so in general, if they're not asking for something like crazy, this is early on when we're just trying to get those first couple of customers. If the question is like, we have it, and I DM her and we're like, yeah, I could build that, then the answer is yes, we'll figure it out, right? We've gone away from that since, but like in those early days, that's kind of what feature requests can look like in a pre-seed company, which is really scary for Steven at the Series A, which really cared about like dates and things that we have and not overcommitting yourself and stuff. But yeah, that's sort of my fun feature request. What was the other question?
You've spent several months, maybe over a year now, building Stand, right? So like you're constantly fighting, at some point you're going to be constantly fighting, I wish this part of the app is really hard to work on, but I also, like, customers just want new things. So can you talk a little bit about making decisions around that?
One thing that's really fun about being a founder, a technical founder, is that I really don't have to ask permission from anyone to do anything, right? And working with a CEO that trusts me, Julie, again, shout out, she's amazing. She trusts my instincts to make prioritization decisions of this tech debt is more important than this customer thing. And so I will basically filter in improving pieces of our system as I'm getting customers' asks out the door. So an example of that is I'm having some issues with our Sentry exceptions right now. I have like an open question in their Discord. And so I've been on and off iterating on that to try to get that right, because for me, error reporting and telemetry is like one of the most important things in our stack, right? Like, as one of the only people staring at the dashboard, I got to have those dashboards work. And so I guess I'm just saying I prioritize my own mental health over a customer where I can. And then I just make it work. And I don't really ask for permission for those sort of things. That being said, we do have a lot of tech debt. There's all kinds of warts of things that are written in weird ways. And you just face them as they come. They basically get rewritten when parts of your system get torn down, replaced with something else. That's how we handle that system.
Growing pains.
Are there parts to being a founder that you talk about how it's nice that you can decide what's important on your own? You don't have to necessarily convince a manager that we really do need to deal with this tech debt before it eats us alive. You've got that trust with Julie. Are there parts to being a founder that you don't really like, that you could do without, but it's just part of the equation?
Yeah, I mean, it's lonely. I'm someone who's spent my entire career working on teams of 5 to 8 with a tech lead and a PM and a designer and shipping stuff to prod every day and rolling on whiteboards. And now it's me and Julie, and we have a salesperson. Sometimes we'll have technical help, but most of the time it's not. And I don't have someone to review my PRs. I don't have someone to be like, I've been stuck on this DocX problem for 2 days that thankfully, right before this call, everything's been solved and DocX is amazing now. But like before that, like it was despair. I was like, I don't know how I'm going to fix it. There's no one I can ask, right? And so there's not a lot of supports out there. So like, you know, today I happen to be at the WeWork. Thankfully, Julie and I were in the same area. And so we co-work once a week. And I'm like, Julie, I want you to pretend like you're a technical person and I'm going to talk to you about what I've been facing. And so she rubber ducked my woes and we got through it together. But yeah, I guess I just sort of missed the camaraderie there. I think the other side that's been really hard is raising money is just, it's tough work, right? It's totally great when you got, you know, a million customers and everyone's throwing money at you and your last company was like Palantir or whatever, some big name. But, you know, you get told no so many times. And I'll say that like the amount of times I've been told no as a software engineer, yeah, you write bad code sometimes, but like it's not being constantly rejected by VCs for like months and months of your life, right? So I think the loneliness and the rejection side is hard, but yeah, I love who I work with. This is the best job that I've ever had. And it's so amazing to have built something and see customers so excited that not only they can use it, but that you're here and that you're improving their lives. And I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Your description, parts of it remind me a little bit of Alan Ullman's book, Close to the Machine. I don't know if you've read that.
I haven't. Would you recommend it?
Yes, I would. It's great. Close to the Machine, Technophilia and its Discontents.
Definitely check it out.
Yes. Awesome. Well, this has been an excellent conversation. Just before we go, do you have any final plugs or requests for the audience?
Plugs about Stand. Sure. If you happen to know anyone that's in venture capital or banking and they're interested in AI, please reach out to us at founders@stand.io. That goes directly to Julie. Not only is that helpful for us from great demo customers, but also we're still learning a lot, right? This is such a deep problem and doing a lot of just customer discovery calls. So if you've got thoughts about how this should work, I'd love to talk to you.
Excellent. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Stephen, for joining us on Elixir Wizards. And thank you to everyone who's listening. We will be back next week with more Elixir Wizards.
Thank you.
Thanks. Great conversation.
Yeah. A lot of fun.
Elixir Wizards is a production of Smart Logic.
You can find us online at smartlogic.io and we're at smartlogic on Twitter.
Don't forget to like, subscribe, and leave a review.
This episode was produced and edited by Paloma Pichenik for Smart Logic.
Thanks for joining us in the Creators Lab, and we'll see you next week for more stories of innovation with Elixir.
Hey, this is Yair Flicker, president of Smart Logic, the company that brings you this podcast. Smart Logic is a consulting company that helps our clients accelerate the pace of their product development. We build custom software applications for our clients, typically using Phoenix and Elixir, Rails, React, and Flutter for mobile app development. We're always happy to get acquainted, even if there isn't an immediate need or opportunity. And of course, referrals are always greatly appreciated. Please email contact@smartlogic.io to chat. Thanks, and have a great day.